Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 92 of HER, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life. And today we talk about her love. Yeah, falling in love. And we want to make sure you know that this episode of HER is made possible by our friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix customized for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, go to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode to rate and review this podcast, because this one's going to be hot, roaring hot. And I read these rates and reviews, so please, please speak to me. All right, it's time for HER.
HER. The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind. Her body. Her life. It's all about her.
All right. So I cannot tell you how happy I am to have on Mandy Catron. Oh my God. She is the author of this amazing piece that came out in the New York Times. And it was all about 36 questions that you want to be able to ask one another to really see if you can fall in love with anyone. Oh my gosh. And of course, this absolutely went viral. You know, when this thing first came out, right, this column, she received more than 8 million views. I was one of them in the first month, and over 400,000 Facebook shares. Oh my gosh. And it received coverage across the world in publications from The New Yorker to The Guardian. It was later made into a podcast read by actress Jillian Jacobs. She's had 2 TEDx talks on love, has received over 4.5 million views combined. Most recently, she started a popular research-based relationship advice column for The Rumpus. And now we have, dun-da-dum, the book, How to Fall in Love with Anyone. Mandy, welcome to the HER podcast.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh. I mean, are you excited about the book?
Yeah, I am. It's been out for about a month now. So I'm just sort of getting used to it being out in the world and having its own life separate from me.
I know they do take on their own life, and it's an exciting journey that you're on, really. And so this book, what do you get in this book that sort of segues off what happened in the original column?
Well, I mean, initially I started researching romantic love about a decade ago, I guess, after my parents' divorce. And I was really surprised by their divorce, and it occurred to me somewhere along the way, and, you know, I was like really struggling to make sense of it. And it occurred to me that maybe part of the problem was their love story. The divorce just felt like the wrong ending to this story. So I started thinking about all the ways that love stories influence our ideas and expectations about romantic love, and I wanted to think about it differently. So I just started doing a bunch of research, which is ultimately how I came across these 36 questions. And what was really interesting was that I had been writing kind of critically about love stories for several years. I started a blog. And then suddenly, after my article came out in the New York Times, I was in the very strange position of seeing my own love story become this sort of mythic thing that I didn't quite believe in anymore. And so that really sort of set me up to think about what it's like, essentially all the ways that love stories shape our ideas about love, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse.
Huh. Well, you know, when I read your love, you know, when I read this modern love column, which is one of the most fun things I do on Sundays, I'm dying to know what happened. What happened to you?
After the column. Yeah,
I mean, the, post column.
Yeah, our relationship You know, it's interesting because in many ways, I feel like the relationship itself is so influenced by all this research I did on love that it's hard to separate those two things, my personal life and my professional life. But yeah, we're still together. And in some ways, I attribute that at least a little bit to having a lot of knowledge about love and sort of empowering myself through doing all this research to be a little bit more intentional about that process.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that turned out to be quite something else on the overall. I mean, it was just the sensation. I cannot begin to tell you how many people I shared that Modern Love column with. I mean, I was just like, you know, emailing that sucker all over the universe. It was just, it was hitting other planets. It was just, it was so fascinating because I'm a physician and a scientist. And so I was fascinated with how you came up with those 36 questions. And what the questions were, like, I think what is a question for, what would constitute a perfect day for you? You know, I had to sit with that one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would be a, and then question 30, when did you last cry in front of another person or by yourself?
Wow. Yeah.
Each question just, you know, this, these weren't like quick little nasty things that you say yes and no to or true and false or whatever and back and forth. Instead, it was, you got to sit with it for a minute. It's like, wait a minute. You had to be introspective, you know, on the overall. So when you did the question, right? I mean, when you did all of these questions and then you integrated this into your book, you came up with some really interesting categories of people and how they relate to one another. So, for instance, you have the exploded star. What's that?
I mean, that's essentially the name of the, so the book is a collection of essays. And the essays, each essay tackles some specific aspect of the way love stories influence our life. I mean, my central idea of the book is basically that there's this gap between how we talk about love and how we actually practice it. And so I think about the book as just like a series of personal essays. So they all involve a little bit of research and a little bit of personal experience or family history or something. And each one essentially like tackles some aspect of that gap between how we talk about love and how we practice it. So The Exploded Star is the first essay in the book. And that essay is really thinking about this question of whether or not there's a right person. And if you can find the right person, and how do you decide who you want to spend your days with, essentially? And it's really about my own experience at the end of a 10-year relationship and trying to decide, you know, do I want to stay in this relationship? And if not, how do I make that decision? And how do I know if I'm ever going to find someone else?
Well, I loved there was this thing that you said, I realized my job was not to choose a good person to love, but to be good to the person I'd chosen. You know,
yeah.
You have to like someone and love them. I thought that that was very profound. I mean, that really hit me. You know, it really resonated with me. It's not just finding some good person to love, like, okay, you know, check. But
yeah.
You got to be good to that person. I mean, you know, this is, it's work, right? It's work. You can't just, mm-hmm. you know, think that this is all just roses and wine. You know, they get sick and they're grumpy too, right?
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it. Right?
And I think with that relationship that it lasted from about age 20 to age 30, what I ultimately realized is we had kind of arrived at this point where we weren't very good at being kind to each other anymore. And once I was able to identify that, I thought, you know, maybe we shouldn't be in this relationship anymore. You know, maybe it doesn't offer us what it could. And that was a useful metric, but it took me a really long time to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. And, the kindness thing is absolutely a monster. I mean, it really is. It's so huge. Just literally showing respect, kindness, being gentle, sensitive, all those things are just intrinsic in something that's going to end up being successful. So that I thought was really wonderful. Looking at you know, I see that throughout the book, what happened with your parents' divorce really, you know, was integrated. I could see the little threads of this, you know, journey with your, you know, trying to suss out what happened with your parents' divorce. So, you know, there was something you talked about, the black box, and you were looking at the prairie vole attachment. And this, yeah, explain that.
So the black box is basically a metaphor for things that we can't know. So like the Google search algorithm, ultimately Google will not tell people, the public, what's in that algorithm. There's also a black box on an airplane when an airplane crashes. And that contains all the information that, like, if no one survives the crash, then we can't know what happened until we can open up that black box, right? So I was interested in this metaphor about the things that we can't know about a divorce, because ultimately, people aren't always comfortable talking about the ends of relationships. And I think that is because sometimes they're just really painful. They're really hard to talk about. And so there's this black box of information that we don't have. And part of that is, like, we don't know what's going on in the brains, like, of, we don't know what's going on in human brains in love. Like, we know a little bit. We sort of, scientists have figured out how to do these fMRI scans of a human brain in love or going through a breakup. But ultimately, we can't, like, slice open the human brain. But one of the things that we have been able to do is study the brains of socially monogamous rodents. So these prairie voles basically are a species of mammal that mate for life. And so biologists have been very interested in, like, what makes these creatures attached to each other. And one of the things that they found that I found just, like, so compelling going through my own breakup and thinking about my parents' divorce is that prairie voles react to the end of a relationship the same way we do. So, like, when they're separated from their partners, they found that, voles normally, so they float and you drop them in water and they sort of swim like crazy, trying to keep themselves alive, but they're ultimately not going to drown because they can float. But what they found is voles that have been separated from their partners, if they dropped them in water, they had no response. Like, they just floated there sort of listlessly, which I just found it, like, such a sad and compelling image. And it felt to me that it really matched my own experiences of going through a breakup. Like, there is this sense of, like, a lost purpose or a loss of meaning. And I really liked, in some ways, or I found comfort in knowing that this is, like, a kind of predictable mammalian phenomenon that, like, we deeply invest
primal.
In other creatures. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just really primal. Yeah.
That made me kind of feel like, all right, I can survive this. It's going to suck, but it's normal. All the feelings I'm having are normal.
How interesting. I'm having this vision of the vole just sort of floating there. How many of us have been there out there? Seriously, have you done the floating vole thing? Yeah, I have. Definitely,
yeah.
Definitely. And yeah, it really, really, really resonates. No question. So here's a really interesting one that I loved, right? So if you can fall in love with anyone, how do you choose? If love is a choice you have to make again and again, you say, you have to choose to love someone with no guarantee they'll always choose you. So help us, you know, understand, if you can fall in love with anyone, how do you choose?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple things to unpack here. So number one, I'm not convinced that you can fall in love with anyone, despite the title of the book. I don't think you could just, like, choose someone on the sidewalk and say, hey, we're going to fall in love and make that happen. But what I do think is that we often have this idea that love is something that happens to us, that we have no control over. And actually, there's a lot of research to suggest that we do have agency and choice in that experience. And one of the ways that I think about that is that, you know, love is a biological phenomenon. We know it's something that happens in our bodies and in our brains, but it's also a social phenomenon. So in other words, like, the ways we think about love are totally dependent on the place and time where you live. And, like, my ideas about love are different from my parents' ideas about love and my grandparents' ideas about love. You know, that there are these generational kind of shifts in ideas. And so ultimately, I get to choose, as does everyone, what to do with that biological response. Like, I get to choose who to spend my time with and who to kind of invest myself in. And I think there's a lot of power in that choice. And we don't often talk about that, which is like the, you know, the really interesting question is like, what kind of person do I want to be with? Do I want to invest my days with? And one thing that I came to realize through the process of doing all this research is that I liked being single. Like, I was able to make a really good single life. And so if I was going to enter into another serious relationship, I wanted it to be with someone who truly made my life better and who I could make their life better. And so this question of like, well, how do you pick someone? Ultimately, I think I was able to reframe it, you know, is this someone who makes me better? And I found that like a very useful question.
Interesting. So, I mean, again, it's all about sitting back and saying, you know, that obviously life is not certain, no question. And that, you know, you don't just make one choice of love in your life. There's probably plenty of opportunities. And in each case, really looking at that whole issue of love and like we said before, which I think mm-hmm. is amazing. What are the pleasures of ordinary devotion that you talk about? What does that mean?
One of the things that I discovered through writing the book, and maybe the thing that was like most personally useful to me, was this idea that love is an ordinary experience. I think so often we talk about romantic love as if it is the most profound, most meaningful human experience that we can have. And I think it can be really meaningful and it can be profound, but it's also really ordinary. Like, most people will experience romantic love at least once over the course of their lives. Most people, multiple times. And sort of knowing that this is something that is predictable, that happens to humans, that happens to other mammals, that happens to species of birds, was like a great relief in some way. And instead of kind of fetishizing love and turning it into this sort of like default assumption of like the best experience a human can have, it was useful for me to kind of think about it as a small part of like a larger life experience. And I think so often we have this idea that there's a right way to practice love. And that way is like you find a partner, like you start dating, you find someone you like, you commit to them into some sort of exclusive relationship, then you move in together. And then you get married and you buy a house and you have children. And so many of our narratives about love imply that that's the way to do it and suggest that if you're not doing it that way, then maybe you're not doing it right. And recognizing that love can be a meaningful part of our lives, but can take lots of different forms, was really liberating for me. Like, it's ordinary, it'll happen, and it can happen in lots of different ways and still be satisfying, which was like a, I don't know, it was like a nice way to reorient my thinking about it.
Excellent. Excellent. I mean, I once again, there are so many, well, as you said, we should seek out stories that expand our sense of what's possible in love. This enables mm-hmm. us to practice love in a way that works for us instead of fitting our lives into the love, marriage, baby, carriage narrative.
yeah.
Which is, I mean, I like the way you said that. I thought that that was spot on. And it was, once again, delving deeper into the difference between fantasy and romanticizing and the reality of what you're actually doing, right? Which I really mm-hmm. think is neat. Tell me about Girl Meets Boy.
So I started thinking about the stories about how two people get together. So often, I think in our culture, they're framed as like a boy meets girl story. And so I thought about my own first relationship and how important it was for me to have a love story. And in many ways, I think when I was like 20 years old and that relationship started, it was as important to me to have a love story as it was to have an actual relationship. And so I was thinking about essentially like, what is it that makes us want a love story? And I think part of it is that we have these social scripts in our culture about what, like, the role of love in our lives. And the scripts can be like a macro script, which sort of tells you, which is kind of that love, marriage, baby, carriage script, which is how love should influence our life trajectory. But there are also these micro scripts, which is like what you should and shouldn't say on a first date. And I realized that in many ways I was trying to fit my own romantic experience into these scripts, because I thought that would ultimately be the thing that was validating and that made it meaningful and that proved that I was sort of an interesting person. And I think so often, especially for young women, we look to romantic relationships as a way to validate ourselves and our value in the world.
Yeah, we do. And oh gosh, you know, it's almost like we heave a sigh of relief if we can make that connection out there and feel like, you know, we've got that love thing. But one of the things we, you know, eventually face is the fact that passion must transform into compassion. And that, you know, it's not always about, you know, the hot and wild and crazy early dopamine, you know, infused months and maybe the first couple of years or whatever it is, that things, mm-hmm. you know, eventually turn into hardcore reality. And if you find yourself not being kind to that person, that could be pretty ugly, you know, as you play it out. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it's difficult because so often what we want is to match our lives and our romantic experiences to these stories. And then, like, when we go off script in some way, we feel like maybe we're failing or we're doing something wrong, and we have this sense of anxiety. And that desire to be on script, I think, often prevents us from asking interesting questions like, do I really want to be with this person? And like, are they good to me? And am I good to them? And what does goodness look like for us? And these questions, I think, are so much more important, but we forget to ask them, especially when we're young.
Wow. So, Mandy, you're a professor at the University of British Columbia. What are you now doing with this whole issue of love? Are you kind of playing with this in terms of research? Are you delving into it in a different way? Are you taking off in a different direction?
So I do lots of things with it. It's kind of taken over my life, this question of romantic love.
I can only imagine. Good Lord.
Yeah. I teach students how to write. I teach both creative writing and academic writing, and I also teach literature classes. And it occurred to me one day that I had been keeping my writing life separate from my teaching life, and that didn't make much sense. So now I've incorporated a lot of the research that I did for the book into my classes. So I have one class where we research romantic love, and they write academic research papers about the sort of science or social science or philosophy, biology, however they want to approach it, of romantic love, which has been really fun. And I learn a lot from my students, which is kind of cool. And I've been teaching a class on the love story. So we read some novels about romantic love and try and think critically about the ways that they influence our ideas and assumptions about how love works in the world. And then I, you know, I'm doing this advice column. I've got a blog, and I don't know. We'll see what's next. But it's keeping me pretty busy right now.
I'm just hoping more wild and crazy things come out of your little lab there, because this was a real epiphany for so many people out there when they actually did the questions and went through the whole exercise. So I want to make sure everyone out there knows that, you know, we are having an absolutely fantastic conversation with Mandy Len, L-E-N, Catron, and that's C-A-T-R-O-N. She is a professor at the University of British Columbia. She's the author of a fabulous book. Please run out and get it. How to Fall in Love with anyone. And you can read her advice column on the Rumpus, RUMPUS.net /topic/mixed feelings. And her blog is theloveStoryProject.ca, because she's in Canada. There you go. And Mandy, I cannot begin to thank you enough for being on the Her podcast and for all your wonderful work on behalf of, well, love. What can I say?
Yeah.
Right?
Thank you for having me.
All right. Of course. And everyone out there, remember to catch all of our episodes of Her. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And please just take a moment and review and rate this podcast on iTunes. Why? Because I read these things, for crying out loud. So come on down. I want to read them. I'm Dr. Pam Peake. So follow me on Twitter at PamPeakeMD, and you can also check out our Her show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening, and stay well.